So good afternoon. A warm welcome to the members and their guests who are here today, and to those listening to us on the stations of Maine Public Radio. This is the 461st meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, and it comes to you from the Elks Event Center in Rockland, Maine. And I'm George Look. The Midcoast Forum was founded 40 years ago next month. And each month we meet to hear an invited speaker on an issue central to the conduct of U.S. foreign policy. You can listen to audios of past forum talks and get information about upcoming forum speakers on our website, midcoastforum.org. Recent forum talks are also on the Maine Public Radio website and now on the Maine Monitor website. If you're interested in staying informed about key foreign affairs issues, please consider becoming a forum member. And that's true of the people who are guests here today, so that you can attend these talks. Our membership form is on the forum's website. We're extremely pleased to have Dr. John Deutsch with us today to speak on challenges to future climate policy. John Deutsch is an Emeritus Institute Professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He has been a member of the MIT faculty since 1970 and has served as Chairman of the Department of Chemistry, Dean of Science, and Provost. Dr. Deutsch has published over 140 technical publications in physical chemistry, as well as numerous publications on technology, energy, international security, and public policy issues. Dr. Deutsch has served in significant government and academic posts throughout his career. He served as Director of Central Intelligence from 1995 to 1996. In this position, he was head of all foreign intelligence agency within the U.S. government, as well as directing the Central Intelligence Agency. From 1994 to 1995, he served as the Deputy Secretary of Defense. From 1993 to 1994, Dr. Deutsch served as Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition and Technology. And from 1997 to 1980, he served in a number of positions in the Department of Energy as Director of Energy Research, Acting Assistant Secretary for Energy Technology, and Undersecretary of the Department. Dr. Deutsch has served on numerous presidential commissions on science, technology, military, intelligence, and policy over several administrations. He has received fellowships and honors from a long list of academies, foundations, government agencies and departments, and nonprofit organizations. In addition, he has served as director or trustee for a number of publicly held companies and nonprofit organizations. To see the impressive list, and I'll tell you it is very impressive, of awards Dr. Deutsch has received and companies he has served, see his bio that is posted on our website. Dr. Deutsch has a Bachelor of Arts in History and Economics from Amherst College, and both a Bachelor of Science in Chemical Engineering and a PhD in Physical Chemistry from MIT. He holds honorary degrees from Amherst College, the University of Lowell, and Northeastern University. When I read through this bio, particularly when you look at the list of impressive achievements, I would think it would be an impressive combination of half a dozen different people's bios. So I'm really impressed. John, I'd like to welcome you to the Midcoast Forum.
I hate these introductions. It's all about my past. I want to hear somebody tell me about my future. That doesn't look as good. I'm very pleased to be here and to speak with you. I particularly like having a full house. That's very... I was here for the Camden Conference. I participated in 2009, and I'm delighted to be here, as I say. I thank George and Karen for a wonderful evening last night for dinner, and Cindy and John Reed for our friends, for having us at their home while we're here, and my distinguished colleague, Carrie Emanuel, who I hope finds nothing of problem in what I speak to you about today. I want to speak to you today about realistic goals, about meeting realistic goals for climate change. I hope it'll be more of a discussion. I know there's a system about questions coming from the audience, but I'm really here to interact with you and I'm looking forward to that. I'm not using slides because I find them tedious and oftentimes keep attention away from the main purpose of what I want to say. So global warming is widely recognized as presenting an existential threat to human activities. Concerted global action is required to make a transition to a carbon-free economy. That's the character of the problem. The goal set by the celebrated 2016 Paris Conference of the Parties was to reduce global emissions to keep global average temperatures below 1.5 degrees centigrade above the pre-industrial level. Now, there was a major disagreement, as you might understand, among nations between who should bear the burden of meeting those emission reductions. There, on one side, there were poor countries, which had high emissions per unit gross domestic product because they were not industrialized and had modernized, but low emissions per capita because they were poor. And then there were rich nations like the United States, which had very low, relatively low emissions per dollar of GDP, but very high per capita emissions. And the question was, how should the costs of adjusting to a carbon-free transition to a carbon-free economy be borne? Should it be on rich nations who are, one, rich, but also had been responsible for all the CO2 emissions and other greenhouse gas emissions that had gone into the atmosphere? Or should it be with respect to rapidly emerging developing economies who are going to be responsible for most of the emissions going forward? That resolution has not happened yet. And so at Paris, there was a different compromise made. I shouldn't say it was a compromise, it was a compromise. And that was every country would state what its national emission reductions were going to be. They had to commit to that. NDCs, nationally determined commitments for reductions. And every nation had a different one. And that took away the issue about quarreling between the countries to letting each person set their own, each nation separate its own goal. At the beginning of the 2020s, it became clear that the countries were not meeting their commitments. That includes, by the way, the United States. So there had to be some other way of approaching the issue than what was decided at Paris. And that issue was to set a new policy for climate change globally, and that was called setting a date on which every country was going to reach zero emissions. That's a much more ambitious target. And every country would say when they were going to meet this net zero. It was a net zero emissions because you could reduce your emissions into the atmosphere, but there would be some things which would be very hard to avoid using fossil fuels for example, long distance aviation, where you have to fly from here to Paris. And so there are some things that have to be emitted, will be emitted, and therefore to compensate for that, that's where the net comes in. You had to take carbon out of the atmosphere by one new technology or another. So the commitment was a goal of net zero emissions by a precise date. So many countries and many corporations have now committed to doing that. The United States is committed to being net zero for all of its electricity by the year 2035, and to be net zero for the entire economy by 2050. The European Community has committed to being net zero for the entire economy by 2050, and China has committed to being net zero by 2060. Now, the question that I want to ask, to pose to you, is, are these aspirational goals or are these realistic goals? Aspirational goals are intended to underscore the importance of the matter. It's intended to encourage groups, to encourage companies and governments to take aggressive action. And it's intended to be something which enables people to be excited about the problem. What is the danger of an aspirational goal? The danger of an aspirational goal is that it sets false expectations. False expectations means that investors have been led to do something which turns out not to be in their interest or not in the interest of the economy. It leads communities and consumers to see that there's still going to be a problem with climate change, but they were told it was going to go away because of net zero. And it basically erodes the confidence of people in the government, in our leaders. So an aspirational goal has the virtue of exciting people or in underscoring the importance of the problem, but it has the deficit of making people, when they see that they're not going to be achieved, to lose confidence in government leadership. What about a realistic goal? Actually, a realistic goal has one terrible disadvantage. It is hugely expensive to do. So I never do this in a talk. McKinsey, which is a consulting firm, estimates that what the United States would have to do to reach net zero for the economy by 2050 is it would have to spend $3.5 trillion each year between now. Well, you know, we're here in Maine. I know that half of you think that's a great thing and half of you think it's a terrible thing, but it's a lot of money. It really is equivalent to one quarter of all the tax revenues of the United States. It's equivalent to 7% of all household incomes in the United States. So this is a huge deal. Now, actually, we are rich enough to do that kind of thing. But there are other countries in the world for which it's a very different matter. And that is, if you consider yourself as a developing country, in India, in Mexico, in South Africa, there's no way that you're going to spend this kind of money to reduce your emissions, because it means you won't be spending money on housing, on education, on health, which is what they're all trying to do to lift their world. So it's a very big dilemma. It's going to be, the result is, the first message for you is, it isn't going to happen. The United States may, Europe may, but the globe will not reduce its emissions by to net zero by 2050. If the United States and Europe do that, the resulting increase in temperature will be less than it would be than if the United States hadn't, but it will still be quite considerable. So one thing which has been clearly understood for a long period of time is that the wealthy nations, the European Union, the United States, Japan, Korea, have to make major transfers of wealth from these countries to the developing countries to allow them to make the investments to reach net zero. So in the Conference of the Parties, which happens annually for all countries, in fact, the Conference of the Parties this year, which is happening in Dubai, will occur at the end of this month for 14 days. At the Conference of the Party in Copenhagen in 2009, the wealthy countries agreed to provide $100 billion a year to the developing countries, $100 billion a year, in order to help them mitigate the damages from climate change and to mitigate emissions. That has not happened. In fact, the wealthy countries, including the United States, are in arrears. So the developing countries, when they reach the conference of the parties later this month, they're going to report that you developing countries are $1 trillion in arrears annually. No, I'm sorry, $1 trillion in arrears until you get up to your $100 billion a year. So this is a big problem. And when I tell you that I want to assess whether this is a realistic objective to get to net zero, I do it in three steps, and I'm going to carry you through all three steps. Let me first of all mention what the three steps are. What circumstances would have to prevail in order for the globe to reach net zero by 2050? Second, what has been the history of the past 50 years of U.S. energy policy? And how does that correspond to the circumstances that must prevail? And the third step is, okay, what do we do about it? So I'm going to take you through this one at a time. Well, here's the deal on what circumstances have to prevail. And I've mentioned several of them already. First, I'm going to do it with respect to the United States, because that's where we're at. All the United States, not only Maine, but also, regrettably, California. So we have to do that. So the first one is, you have to have a stable policy for 30 years between now and 2050. The second one is, you have to have a financial arrangement that is now agreed upon to transfer money from the United States, not all of $100 billion, but certainly a big fraction of it, to the developing world. Third, it's a little bit discouraging, there can be no international disruptions. By that I mean war, pandemic, or collapse of financial markets for some exogenous reason. There has to be rapid development of technical innovation. That is new technology, but also deploying that technology, which is what I mean by innovation. That has to take place. This next comment, if it gets a laugh, I'll be very unhappy. There has to be swifter and more efficient U.S. government decision making. I know, isn't there an electricity transmission line that is at issue here? And that's the kind of thing which doesn't help the problem, because if you're going to go from fossil fuels to electricity, you're going to need a lot more electricity transmission lines. And then also the United States has to bend its shoulder to try to reorganize the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which allows all 192 nations to have an equal voice of the way forward. Those are the conditions that have to occur if we're going to make net zero by 2050. So let me now review for you very briefly what the last 50 years of experience has been in energy policy. The first is that the longest that any political party has been in the White House has been 12 years. So you have to say, well, we're not going to have a political party there for 30 years. But for 12 years, it actually was Ronald Reagan plus H.W. Bush. Secondly, you have to have a consistent policy about how you're going to get to 2050. But if you look backwards, there have been many, many major shifts in U.S. energy policy. When I started, the question was, we're going to do everything by nuclear power. And there was a celebrated friend of Pat's family who said, nuclear power is going to be too cheap to meter. That policy lasted for a little while in the Nixon and Bush administration, and It lasted a little while, but as you know, the history of nuclear power has not been terrific in the United States or in elsewhere in the world. A few places it has been. The second policy shift, and everybody's forgotten this, is Jimmy Carter came in with a completely new approach to energy policy, saying it was the highest priority for the country. And he said one of the important things is to shift from oil and natural gas to coal. Why? It was cheap, it was abundant, and it was domestic. There was a law passed saying that you could not burn natural gas in major fuel burning installations like a utility, because the molecule, and this I have a lot of sympathy for, the molecule is too precious. You had to burn coal. And then things went well. The United States is now the largest producer of oil and gas of any nation in the world. So before, while we were, in the Nixon administration, when OPEC happened, we were worried about domestic vulnerability. Today we are the deal in oil and gas markets, and we are able to turn our attention from the whole issue of oil and gas, really, to what do we do about climate? So that's the third major policy shift. So you can account on the fact that over the next half century, and I'm going to mention one or two of them, there's a possibility of another major shift from are we going to make net zero or not? No progress has been made on agreeing to a level of support for the developing countries. I don't need to remind you that there have been continued international disruption. We now have an unusual situation where there are two serious wars going on the globe. Mercifully, U.S. combat forces aren't directly involved, but both Israel, Hamas, and Ukraine and Russia are very, very serious wars that are going on, for which there doesn't seem to be any near resolution. And it doesn't need to be remind you that there has been no fundamentally shift in the U.S. decision-making methods, practices in the last 50, well, just before. So one time that I'm familiar with in the history of the country, there was a change, and that was when the Second World War occurred, and the whole nation, as a nation, said we are going to give the War Production Board all authority on how our industry was going to meet the defense needs of the Second World War. But short of that, the kind of integrated, all-in-government effort does not exist now, and you have dozens of committees in Congress dealing with dozens of agencies. And although the president says we need an all-of-government approach, it's not clear how to do it within that context. What about technology? Well, there's been good news and bad news. I think perhaps the most important one from the point of view of this transition is that the unit costs of wind and of photovoltaics have gone way, way down much more rapidly and much deeper than people thought. So there are some, but there are also other issues. Decarbonizing industries like cement, steel, chemicals, still remains in an economically attractive way, or even an economically possible way, still remain out of reach. And there's also the more now increasingly recognized that if we don't use oil and gas, we're going to have to use metals, critical materials, which most of them are in the hands of the Chinese and in Africa, to build our electricity systems that are going to be increasingly important to a carbon-free economy. So that's where we are. Finally, I'll note that this upcoming Conference of the Parties, which is occurring in Dubai, is the 28th conference of the parties. So we've had 28 years of people going and having brie cheese and white wine in one capital of the world or another, discussing these issues, oftentimes very, very always very intelligently. But the word action has not often been used. That's kind of the state of affairs when you compare it to what the requirements are. So I want to say to you, well, what should we do? Now, what I tell you what we should do, given this discrepancy between the historical record and the necessary conditions to get to net zero, what are we going to do? Well, you could either do what we've been doing in the past, muddle through, take it step by step, or you can say we have to have a completely different approach. So I want to say there is one approach to dealing with global mitigation, reduction in emissions, and that is to do it more or less on a regional basis. The United States says we're going to deal with the Western Hemisphere. We're going to deal with North America and South America. The United States is going to be the moving force in making sure that the whole Western Hemisphere comes to net zero. We're going to have Europe responsible for Asia. Let me get this correspondence right. Europe responsible for Africa and the Near East. Japan and China for the Far East, and the UK gets the special responsibility for India. Some sort of a regional. We're not doing better now. Now that means that you disenfranchise like a large number of the 192 nations who have an equal vote, but at least there may be a possibility of getting more done. I don't promise you that, I'm just saying there are other alternatives one can imagine. It is clear that since it doesn't look like we are going to meet net zero, and a subsidiary conclusion would be that we are probably, or almost surely, going to go above 2.5 or 3 degrees centigrade. Here I would ask my colleague Kerry Emanuel to say what is his guess about what global temperature increase will be by the year 2000. But it's clear that we have to pay more attention to adaptation. Temperature goes up, there'll be impacts which are very, very serious on human health, on communities, different parts of the world. There'll be a lot more desertification, a lot more problems in Africa and Asia. Adaptation is really something that's going to take place, and it can either take place in a way which is painful for communities and for families, or measures can be taken today, like an insurance policy, to assure that the adverse impacts of climate change are less than they would have been if you don't pay any attention. What are some examples? You can build seawalls to cities and communities which live at the edge of the landmass, where they anticipate, although there's some uncertainty about how quickly, rising levels of the sea. You can do a better job of managing forests to avoid forest fires, which are very, very difficult for communities and emit a lot net to the other. So these are measures which could take place. And indeed, both the international climate community and the United States does understand that adaptation is a place where we have to go. But it's not clear, there's no market mechanism here, there's no industry which does adaptation. I always like, you know, when you go and talk to somebody in Miami, they'll say, well, we need to have a wall built all around, like in Venice, all around Miami. And the way to handle this is like we handle flood assistance. If people live near the water, we have to subsidize their flood insurance rather than telling them they have to pay it. That's an expense on the community, and we're not going to subsidize it. So it's not clear, but Miami's quite clear. They're not going to do that by a state tax. They're going to build that wall by going back to the federal government and having them pass a subsidy for it. So adaptation is what I would call an aspiration. It's an aspiration with a little bit more muscle because people really think it will. The Obama administration, and perhaps even certainly not the Trump, referred to it as building climate resiliency. Adaptation was building, because if you use climate resiliency, it could lead to a broader range of possible projects to do it. So I want to conclude here with both a summary statement and a personal concern. The summary statement is that if you're going to deal with climate change, it has to be done honestly and directly on a global basis. It can't be just done, you know, by the United States and Europe, who can afford it. And absent massive capital transfers to the developing countries, there's not a chance of it happening. And even if they agree to give the money, how that money will be managed is a very important matter and certainly not resolved. So you can expect that sometime in the next, I would say, 2 or 3 years, people say that net zero is not the right climate goal because it's not a realistic goal. And some other well-intentioned and perhaps well-informed goal for the country will be substituted. I think that's almost a certainty. It's happened in the past, and we will have a new important goal to consider as we move forward. That's my statement. So let me tell you what's my worry. When I talk about an important public policy issue, and ask, and one should do this all the time, is it a realistic policy? More often than not, I find that we tend not to want to straight look at what is realistically happening and hope for the best. So if you say, look, let's look realistically at what is happening here, it runs the risk of saying, boy, that's a pessimistic message. And we shouldn't be dealing with pessimistic message. We should be dealing with uplifting messages. So my personal concern is when you give a realistic assessment, it runs the risk that people say, hey, this guy's a pessimist. We're not going to have him back. Or if he comes back, there'll be many fewer people here. That's even worse. But in point of fact, if you want good people involved in big, important public policy issues, it's got to be realistic. And you have to be able to say, we've got to turn the pessimism into a new opportunity that will hopefully work better. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, John. It's nice to have a little bit of a positive spin on what's ordinarily not a positive topic, I think. I always take while they're collecting questions from the audience, and I want to encourage people, as John starts answering questions, if you have follow-up questions, please try to submit those as well, and I'm going to make a big attempt here to do a little more interaction by trying to get some of those follow-up questions in as we move forward. I always take this opportunity, though, to ask a question of my own while others are doing it. And, you know, I've heard that there are, even if we had approached net zero today, there are long-term effects of having the amount of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. If we go to net zero by 2050, does that end all the problems?
Well, first of all, you correctly say that what was really the problem is the inventory of CO2 and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. So if you get to net zero, all it says is you're not putting in more. And what is the actual effect on the climate depends on the, at that moment, concentration of the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. That's the concentration that matters. Will that go away? It will go away in a few hundred years if you don't add any more. So the lifetime of CO2 in the atmosphere is on the order of 250 years. See, that's an not helpful comment. Professor Carey points out that half of it will go away in 300 years, and the rest it'll be 3,000 years. Yeah. And that's if nothing else is added.
Someone wants to know, what do you expect the reaction will be when populations realize that we can't control the climate? All the climate change problems. I mean, we are being too optimistic now, and in the way that it's being presented. Do you think people realize we're not going to meet things?
I think any person in industry or in universities probably realizes that this is a bridge too far.
Okay. You've mentioned nuclear, and I know they're developing new types of smaller reactors, et cetera. Can nuclear play a large role in the future energy picture?
I teach this class at MIT, and this year I asked how many people in this class, there are all kinds of people in there, how many people in this class favor nuclear power? Everybody in the class, all the students raised their hands and said they favored nuclear power. If I'd asked that question 3 or 4 years ago, I would have been lynched. It is actually the fact that among younger people that I interact with, their recognition of the balance of having a reliable, not emitting technology with all of its problems, safety, proliferation, waste, is better than not having nuclear. So I think there will be a move back towards nuclear very much in the world. Some places not at all, like Germany. But there's, in my experience is, yes, people are much more open to nuclear power. And that's a good thing.
There's a lot of them on the nuclear question here. Is it possible, let me switch gears a little bit, is it at all possible to quantify the impact that wars like Israel and Gaza and the Ukraine and Russia have on delaying this process?
I don't know that you could do that in a technically sound way, but it certainly does take the attention of your leaders away from climate to more urgent matters. But you also see that when you have something like the Russia-Ukraine war, it completely disrupts European markets. The price of natural gas goes up so that they're paying so much more that the countries all in Europe have to subsidize homes. So it has an immediate effect of the market, a market effect, but the more serious effect is that it turns our attention from dealing with Russia from dealing with climate.
Well, you enumerated a number of adjustments that are going to have to be made, but one thing you didn't really address is the effect that climate change will have on migration, world migration. Could you talk about how that's going to
I say that out? It goes in steps. There are droughts, there's migration, there's war. So all of that will happen, and you see some of the migration effects happening now, but the certainly no question about it that migration will lead to conflict because people go from one part of the to somebody else's part of the turf.
Someone points out that, you know, even though China has this goal of 2060 that you mentioned, it's still building coal-fired power plants for itself and other countries. And India is still rapidly emitting CO2. Africa's barely turned on to this. And the U.S. and Europe can't possibly counter all of that. Is there any hope? I mean, for the world at large.
Well, I mean, it's exactly my unwillingness to say that there's no hope, that there is hope. And all of those countries can be influenced by, first of all, the capital transfer that I think is certainly part of the solution. And many of them, particularly India, I think is open to a much more, I will use the word cooperative way of addressing these emission problems. China's a more complicated question. And as you know, one of the great achievements of Obama was to reach this agreement with Xi that they were going to have a common U.S.-Chinese environmental and climate problem. So I think there is some effort. And they're only building 100 new coal plants this year. Usually they build more. And they're very efficient coal plants. They're really quite good.
And someone's got, here's a question someone had in kind of the opposite direction. The European Union countries are being much more successful with electrification and transition to green energy. Can we learn from them in terms of policies and how to do it?
There is an interesting point, and that is we have a tendency in America, when we want the whole system to move, to give subsidies, tax credits. President Obama has just given, I know, $560 billion in grants and tax credits to induce industries to do something in the hopes that that will catalyze real progress. The Europeans do it more by regulation, saying next year you have to be this much more efficient in your energy policy. So as my friend Ernie Moni says, we don't deal with carrots and sticks. We deal with carrots and twigs. And so there really is an issue here that, they're heavy-handed and sometimes they make big mistakes in Europe. But I do think that their houses, they also have much less global leadership than the United States has. Ex-Trump.
And to continue on with the regions of the world, or particular countries in this case, France uses nuclear power more than any other country. How do they rank in terms of their CO2 emissions? Is it really helping?
Well, I think that France's CO2 emissions are lower because their electricity sector is much more nuclear-based, 70% relative to 20% for the United States. I don't know how it adds up if you look at all their industry activities and, incidentally, their imports and exports, because another way to handle this problem is to import carbon-intense products to your country so that the emissions are really counted in their country when they make the product. Right?
And someone wants to know about the balance between adaptation and reduction. Does not adaptation reinforce the idea that rather than reducing emissions to net zero, we can just keep going and adopt? Adapt?
First of all, it's interesting that all of the reports of the past conference and the parties indicate that the priorities should be the same for adaptation and mitigation. It doesn't mean that it's happened. They just, every thoughtful heads of these conference parties have said it hasn't happened. but it is normally said should be 50-50. Now, does it take your attention away from it? I don't know. We're not making such progress with the mitigation, so yeah, I think adaptation should be 50. It's a little bit like saying, how do you feel about insurance policies? If you're, you know, nothing is better than an insurance policy that doesn't work. So if adaptation, you know, it's not needed, but you've made investments, you're still in better shape than the other way around. If you haven't done mitigation and you really get a big bang, then you'd want to have a very severe, very strict adaptation program.
And there's a series of questions of people wanting to know about different types of either renewable or clean energy and what their role can be. One is in fusion. Is fusion really something we're going to be able to see in our lifetime?
Some
people's lifetime. A poor choice on my part.
Am I allowed to? Is it all right to say a personal statement here?
No.
So there I was, a young guy, really good young guy, in 1978, in the Carter administration, director of energy research, and the secretary came into my office, Jim Schlesinger, I mean a really tough guy, and said, I want you to cancel the fusion program. All, every penny gone, zero. I've been doing this, he said, for 30 years, and when I started as chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, I was told fusion is 30 years away. It still seems to be 30 years away. Cancel it. And I went away and I said, I'm sorry, I'm taking too much time.
No, don't, please.
I said, I got to change his mind. I mean, you can't have the director of energy research zero out all of fusion energy. So I got together four guys, who I knew he respected, and I said, hey, go away and do a whole assessment of both all the fusion alternatives, both particle fusion and magnetic fusion, and come back and tell me what should be the strategy for the country. And they came back with a fantastic report. In the end of it, there was a chart which showed here is a timeline going all the way from today, necking down, getting rid of different alternatives, till finally the last point said, first commercial reactor, 2005. Well, sounded great in 1978, and Schlesinger was completely angry with me. He says, okay, fund them. But it's past 2005. In the best estimates that I've seen are for, guess what? 2035. Now at MIT, we're head over heels in love with, what's the name of the? Commonwealth Fusion. Don't put your kids' money in it.
That's a little discouraging, actually.
There are about 15 companies in the United States now which have different fusion approaches, some very stellarators, very different, clever approaches. And they are getting a lot of private capital. But each one of those, to go through this whole scheme of making it work, is a $5 billion journey. So our problem with fusion today is not that there are a lot of good ideas, but there's not a sensible financial plan. You're never going to get, you know, all the money you need to follow all those. So how do you neck it down? But as I say, it's not going to happen on my lifetime.
But how about tidal power? Is there a future for tidal power?
Tidal.
The tides. Use the tides for power.
Yes. Yes. Depends on where you are. But I think the answer to that, yes. It's not going to be of the scale you need. Yeah. That's, you know, the tides come in and out. That provides a change in potential energy and change into kinetic energy. You got electricity, yeah. But it's not of the scale that you need, and of course it depends. It's hard to do in Switzerland.
There's a pilot there, has been there for 20 or 30 years, a pilot tidal plant in Canada, in Nova Scotia. remember the name of the town right now. But they found that the environmental effects of that it had on the river, they were using the tide coming out of the river, were so significant that they haven't abandoned it, but they haven't built any more for that. I mean, so the question is, what is the balance between saving the environment and some of the technologies like using tidal?
But there are many, many different cases where there were momentary or more than momentary looks at an energy technology that proved not to be worthwhile. Ocean energy, what is it called? Getting energy out of the ocean because of the temperature difference is another one where senators from Hawaii are particularly keen on it. But it turns out when you look at it, it doesn't bear. So there are many different technologies which have not shown as much commercial and reality is thought.
How about geothermal energy? Drilling down deep enough to use the heat of the Earth's crust.
There are a lot of people who are very keen on geothermal. I do not go to that church.
And let's move to technologies, to kind of the incentive type of questions. Someone wants to know, can you speak to the importance, the potential of carbon tax and dividend mechanisms to accelerate the transition of energy systems? What are the right incentives?
So there's nothing more, well, I'm making too many jokes. Four times in the last 50 years, an effort has been made at a charging for the costs of the emission, the social costs of the emission, in four different ways. They all failed. I can tell you each one of them. The first one was John Sawhill wanted to put a tax on gasoline. My president, he wanted to put a BTU tax, just all BTU gets. Then there was the famous effort on a cap and trade system to internalize the external costs of increasing greenhouse gas emissions, put that cost back into the system, let the system adjust to it, because now that cost is reflected properly in the decisions that they make. Why does that not happen? It's only economists who think it's a good idea. If you go to anybody who has ever had a political event in his life, or her life, the answer is, who's going to gain and who's going to pay from that tax? So if you want to get a tax passed, you have to tell me how you're going to spend the proceeds. So it's not enough to say we're going to have a carbon tax. You have to say, and here's how we're going to spend the proceeds. And the only person who I knew personally who knew how to do that was Tip O'Neill. That's the way you got the controls, price controls taken off of oil and gas, was by him saying, we're going to spend that money on people in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And he was in a place that, he really said that money, there's going to be an excess profits tax, which is going to be focused on elderly people and homeless people and a whole set of people. So if you tell me you want a carbon tax, which is intellectually the right way to making industry adjust, you have to say, how are you going to use the revenue? The final word on this is George Shultz, famous former Secretary of Labor, Secretary of Treasury, Secretary of State, proposed that what you did with the revenue is you put it into an envelope and you sent that envelope every month, the revenue, to every family in the country. So that was a way to make sure that you recycled it to great political. So one smart ass economics professor at MIT, who's terrific, did a study, that amounts to a transfer payment from the central part of the country to both the West Coast and the East Coast.
I think we have time for maybe a couple more questions. One is the regional approach you included, where we would, help. Is anybody considering it? Are decision makers within the government thinking about this approach?
There are people who talk about it, but I don't think there's anybody who's got any authority or real responsibility who thinks. But I think it would be just very, very, it's interesting. The United States, when we talk about U.S. energy policy, we always draw a picture of the United States. We don't draw a picture of North America, but we are deeply, deeply, we consider the oil and gas that comes from Canada just the same way we do as if it comes from Saudi Arabia. So there's something really bizarre about not looking at it on a regional basis. I consider Canada more reliable than California, so I mean, why not?
And then finally, what are you and what should we be doing as an individual to help? Buy an electric vehicle, fly less, turn down the thermostat, move to Maine?
All of the above?
All of the above.
Know how to do is I teach kids.
Good answer. Thank you very much.